The first case for argument this morning is 23-1094, Platform Science v. Omnitrax. Mr. Richards, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Oliver Richards on behalf of Platform Science. May it please the Court. This Court should vacate the Board's decision and remand with appropriate instructions to apply this Court's inherency and anticipation case law faithfully. The factual record here on appeal is largely not disputed. We have a claim here that requires at least one information from one field to be copied from a received message to a response message. The facts about the prior art are similarly not really in serious dispute. It teaches the same configuration of a received message, a response message.
Can I just ask you, just so when you go on, maybe you can incorporate my thinking. You mentioned inherency and anticipation. But isn't what the Board identified as lacking here was an argument with respect to obviousness?
Certainly. There was the second part of our claim of error is obviousness, and it has to do with the Board parsing, you know, the petition and trying to draw this, I would say, artificial distinction between field mapping and copying. Field mapping is how the copying is done, and then it just entirely ignored the obviousness arguments. Certainly, you know, we've set forward, we believe there is error with respect to how the Board treated obviousness or how the Board didn't treat obviousness. And on the
Why are you saying that it should be remanded for anticipation and inherency?
Well, and also to consider the obviousness arguments that were made and not considered. I would say that that should also be part of any remand. This is, I think, one of those cases that sits on a fine line between anticipation and obviousness. Certainly, we think that, you know, as according to the undisputed facts, you know, the reference actually does teach copy. You know, the facts here are the same IOD appears in the received message and in the response message. And using the language of the patent, it says the IOD is sent back. There's no discussion of the IOD ever being displayed to the user. And again, there's no dispute about this. The only input methods disclosed are a set of arrow keys, soft keys. Our contention below was that it would be a reasonable inference from these things to conclude that automatic copy. You know, this Court's case law embraces this reasonable inference, you know, going back to Baxter from the...
So you want to point me to your petition? Because that's the crux of the matter, unfortunately, is down in the weeds, which is what you said and what you didn't say. So did you say the crux of the matter is obviousness, whether copying would have been obvious?
Sure, I'd point the Court to Appendix 116 to begin with. And there it says, to the extent that it's not explicitly disclosed, it would have been inherent or obvious. The copying would have been inherent or obvious.
Where is that? To the extent that it's deemed not explicitly or inherently disclosed, the information field of a received message is copied. I mean, I'm not sure. And there you're talking about the information field. You're not talking about the notion of you're talking about field mapping versus the notion of whether or not there was copying at all here.
I would disagree with the characterization. I think that we would say that it was both copied and that it had to be copied using field mapping information. I think the context of this statement is also important. We had a ground of anticipation and or obviousness. Maybe inadvisable to combine them in hindsight, but nonetheless we had a ground solely on copy. Right, and so what we said, and again, and what the petition says is that copying is actually taught, and to the extent it's not taught, it would have been obvious.
Where do you say that?
I think it's not in those words verbatim. I think that is embraced in what's in the first sentence of paragraph 116. To the extent that copy is not deemed to explicitly and inherently disclose that information from an information field of received message is copied, it would have been obvious.
Here's my problem. I get what you're saying, but the standard of review is abuse of discretion. The Board seems to, particularly in oral argument, look for you to tell it what it is, the theory. And maybe they were looking for you to say obviousness of the copy. And your answer, not you, but the answer for your client was inherency. And the Board could reject that if that was the only theory, right? So you're not saying the Board was, that inherency should have been the answer. You're saying that the Board should have read the petition as also including obviousness. I don't know. That's a question. What are you arguing?
Sure. I think the answer was inherency primarily. Sometimes in the heat of oral argument, get interrupted and didn't get to give a full answer. But, I think we were confused by the board's confusion, again, because what was in the petition was this reasonable inference, that anticipation allows for drawing a reasonable inference. And where the board went wrong with respect to anticipation is it applied an ipsimis verbis test. And, this is pretty clear in the board's opinion at Appendix 39 to 40. Where it discusses our argument. Petitioner concludes this portion of the petition stating, it is reasonable to imagine that a person of skill at the art would have not left such a tedious task to be performed by a computer rather than a human. It's discussing, what are the reasonable inferences that could be drawn from the prior art. And then the board goes on to say, reasonable to imagine is not how one determines whether a claim limitation is disclosed by a reference. Respectfully, I think the court's precedents say exactly the opposite. In the Baxter case, this court's or the court's predecessor said, the operative question for anticipation is what a skilled artisan would understand for a reference and what a skilled artisan would reasonably infer from that reference. Now, going on to what you were getting at is the kind of waiver question. We certainly presented a ground on obviousness. It is, I think, a pretty black letter, typical obviousness case. I think that what we did in our petition was fair to raise that obviousness case. It certainly was before the board. Did we put it out as extensively as we've laid it out in our blue brief? I have to admit that no. But nonetheless, to the extent this court has any concerns, the forfeiture doctrine it's a discretionary doctrine by this court. And looking at the capsule case that was cited in the briefs, that the record here is fully developed. There's certainly enough facts that have been developed for this court to ask the board to have taken a look at it. We think the board should have taken a look at it below rather than parsing, trying to figure out what theory. The theories were anticipation and obviousness. Both of those were before the board. Again, I do want to briefly talk about inherency. There's been a lot of discussion back and forth about some of the inherency case law. As kind of pointed out in our blue briefs, this is not a classic case of inherency where you have a process or a machine disclosed in the prior art. The normal operation of that machine results in a certain result. This is kind of like the not explicitly disclosed. It's there, but, we have to look into the mind of a skilled artisan to understand what the skilled artisan would do.
But I guess on the legal issue of inherency, if we accept that there's evidence for the notion that a manual entry was a realistic possibility in Coffee, then doesn't your inherency argument fail as a matter of law?
I take issue with some of the premise of that question, and I know that
then consider it a hypothetical and answer that, and then you can tell me why the premise is wrong.
If this court considered that to be a reasonable possibility, I would say that maybe the inherency bucket wouldn't apply, but I don't agree that it is a reasonable inference to be drawn from what the teachings of the art are. Namely, there's some discussion in Coffee about, we want to avoid this manual entry. Manual entry it's a three-digit number. And is it reasonable to expect a person in a truck to push up, down, left, right hundreds of times in order to manually input this number? I don't think that's a reasonable inference from the prior art. The only evidence in support of that was the testimony of their expert. I think that it's not a reasonable inference from the prior art. Similarly, the other explanation they offered was this counter. There's, again, no evidence in support of that. I think in order for us to have to disprove this, we don't have to disprove all speculative possibilities. I think everyone in this room would imagine that if they had an expert come down and said, aliens input this number.
If you have an expert come in and say, I've read Coffee and it's absolutely clear to me that the only realistic possibility did not include manual.
Yes, exactly that. I'd point the court, for example, to Appendix 1513, which is the deposition of our expert. Of course, he said similar things in his declaration, but at that point, he's asked by opposing counsel specifically, isn't it possible to have manual entry? He said, no, it's impossible. Impossible was the word he used.
Because?
Because of the way the entry works, this manual entry, there's four arrow keys. I mean, is it beyond a reasonable doubt? Perhaps not, but the standard here isn't beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, we're talking about a preponderance of the evidence to show that this is necessarily what Coffee teaches. And he said this is a person would not do it this way. Was his testimony.
And well, there may be some ground between a person wouldn't have done it manually and the notion that it was necessarily the copying here was necessarily present. Are there any other options, explanations?
I mean, there were the option that we presented was this automatic copying. There were the two other options presented by the other side, neither of which we thought rose beyond the level of just pure speculation. And I don't think inherency involves disproving every speculative possibility.
But doesn't... Do you agree that the argument, the discussion we're having here sort of sounds more like an obviousness discussion than an inherency discussion?
I would say that there's probably some similarities, you know, and I've spent some time thinking about this, is when we look into the mind of a skilled artisan, what separates anticipation from obviousness? Because I think there's no doubt that both involve looking into the mind of this hypothetical skilled artisan. I think the difference would be that in the anticipation world, as this court's precedents and Baxter say, you know, we can look in there, but if it involves any amount of creativity, you know, changing a reference, for example, what was discussed in NIDAC, if you have to change something, that's creativity, you're in the world of obviousness. If you're just simply looking into the mind of a skilled artisan to say, how would you understand this reference? And then we're in the world of anticipation. So, I would say that this case kind of rides the line between anticipation and obviousness. I think it probably presents better as an obviousness argument. You know, again, as the facts developed as they did below, where there's a set of three known possibilities, I think it fits directly into this court's case law, like Uber, Acco Brands, etc., where you have a number of design choices. You're presented with a design need, namely, how do I get this information from this field to this field? And you have a number of known design choices for accomplishing that. I think it's a textbook Uber Acco Brands type case. We have a design need and known design choices in a very limited set, even given all the creativity.
So if you're agreeing obviousness was the most apparent, you were given an opportunity by the board to at least show the board, where did you make this argument in your petition? And you didn't do that. You shifted towards a different argument of inherency. Then why under abuse of discretion standard, notwithstanding, I mean, perhaps there are some boards that would have gone the extra mile and done something differently or raised different questions to force something out of you that you didn't say yourself. But why does this fail as an abuse under abuse of discretion?
Well, I'd say the board here didn't just stop at that answer. I mean, the board itself did conduct almost line-by-line analysis of the petition. It was looking at the petition. And I think misread the petition. So I think the abuse of discretion here would be how the board read the petition. There was clearly an anticipation ground, and then there was clearly an obviousness ground presented.
Well, did the board, you had a chance to show the board where you made the argument of obviousness, right? And is what you gave to the board what you gave to me on page 116 of the appendix? And under an abuse of discretion standard, wasn't the board free to read that you didn't preserve that argument?
I would think during the rebuttal time, we did come back and specifically point them to these pages, yes, after we had a chance to sit down and look at the petition. I believe that is appendix, I don't have the pin site here, but it's towards the end of the oral discussion. It's in the second kind of snippet that we put forward, is we did have an opportunity. We pointed them directly to this page.
Thank you. What will we serve your rebuttal?
Apologies if we're not looking at the clock.
Well, I'm the one that's asking you the questions, and I'm not going to apologize. Mr. Wilcox, please proceed.
Thank you, Judge Prost, and may it please the Court. Jason Wilcox on behalf of Omnitrax. I'm happy to discuss either the inherency or the obviousness arguments, but let me start with obviousness. And I think you're exactly right, Judge Prost, that at Appendix 544, the Board explicitly asked them, what's your theory for copying, or what's the principle you rely on? And they said, inherency. I think the board is then allowed to take them at their word, but the board went beyond that to make sure that they got a fair shake. As my friend on the other side pointed out, the board in its opinion spent 6 pages of its discussion from Appendix 37 to 42 trying to unpack and understand the arguments that they made. And it came to the reasonable conclusion that the arguments they made, including the argument on Appendix 116, were not making an obviousness argument for copying. They were instead, at most, making an obviousness argument for the separate field mapping limitation. And assuming that copying had already been established based on the arguments that they made on Appendix 115.
No, I appreciate that, but the starting point, and I started there too, so yep. I'm not blaming yep. you for that. Why is that the right starting point? I mean, part of what went down here, it seems to me, is they were thinking about this conflating the field mapping issue with the copying. And they are sort of one in the same if you look at them in a certain way. And to what extent is field mapping doesn't exist if not for copying from one field to the other? So I think their obviousness case was clearly made with respect to field mapping, and the board didn't accept that because they wanted a predicate obviousness analysis on the copying piece of it. But why is it improper to conflate the two in the way we're thinking about this case?
Well, I think it's proper to conflate them because what the board did was it looked at the way that the argument was presented in the petition and said that the way that the obviousness case for field mapping is being argued is it's not being argued that it would have been obvious to copy and therefore obvious to do field mapping. Instead, the way that it was laid out, if you look at Appendix 115, and also if you look at Appendix 110 to 111, is the argument was, well, you have these two fields that are the same between the original message and the response. Therefore, there must be copying. And then all the arguments that flow after that, whether you're looking at Appendix 111 to 112 or whether you're looking at Appendix 116, depending on which limitation you're looking at, then start from that premise that we've already established copying, and now I'm explaining to you why it would have been obvious to use field mapping if you've already established that there's copying. And you can see that, for example, at the top of Appendix 116, right before the sentence that my friend on the other side read. They first say that the disclosure that's in copy, that they've talked about, the fact that there's these two fields that are the same, means that copy did employ copying because otherwise the message would not automatically include information from the two. And then they go on to say, moreover, if the copying were not performed based on field mapping, items of information extracted from the received message would not appear in the response message. So they're not saying, well, if we have copying, and they think they've already established copying, here's why you'd have to have field mapping. If you look at the arguments that they then make on the rest of Appendix 116, they're all flowing from that same premise. For example, the final sentence on that page says specifically, a person of skill in the art would have recognized that without field mapping information, information received in the received message could not be copied to appropriate corresponding fields. That's assuming that you know that you're doing copying. It's not an argument about why it would have been obvious to do copying. So I think at the minimum, given the standard of review that applies here, which is abuse of discretion, the board has wide leeway to read this. I think they read the petition in a reasonable way. And under cases like Microsoft versus EnFish, that is enough to affirm the board's decision.
What about if they had done otherwise? Would you have a basis to challenge them if they had read into it? If they had pressed counsel to, like, talk about obviousness in the context of copying, would you be here arguing that that was improper, or do you consider that within their discretion?
No, I think if the board had looked at this and they had said there's an obviousness argument there, we would disagree with it. But I don't know that I could win on an abuse of discretion standard of review because I think the board has a wide leeway to read how the petition is framed. But I certainly think that here, when you have, again, them saying explicitly, our theory is inherency, the board recognized that this was confusing and hard to unpack. It wanted to understand, how do I unpack that? And it asked them that, how do I unpack that? And they said, our theory is inherency.
And what about anticipation, though? Because they did preserve the anticipation. And this seems to, our cases say it's when one skilled in the art would reasonably understand or infer from the prior art reference that every limitation was disclosed. So the standard is different than inherency. Why didn't they meet that test that one skilled in the art would have reasonably understood? Didn't they have an expert that said that?
Well, two reasons, Your Honor. Number one is, again, they disclaimed any anticipation theory other than inherency to the board at Appendix 544, and the board took them at their word and when at Appendix 46 to 47 in its decision. But also, under that standard, even if you think they made an anticipation argument, though, it still has to be that all the elements are expressly there. And the element of copying isn't expressly there. Coffee, the reference, is just simply silent about how the information gets
over. Is that what our cases say, that it was expressly there? I thought at least one case, DACO, says someone skilled in the art would have reasonably understood or inferred that the teaching was disclosed in the reference.
So DACO is an inherency case? And what DACO means by that reasonably understood or inferred is that they would have reasonably understood or inferred that it was necessarily present in the reference, even though it wasn't expressly disclosed. And in DACO, this court in fact reversed and said, no, it isn't inherent, because even reading it from that perspective, it's not necessarily present. And here we had an expert at Appendix 1349 that explained how you could do this through manual data entry. So the board, at worst, had competing experts and got to decide which one to credit. But their expert also said at Appendix 1529, he was asked, was there anything in Coffee that makes it so it's not possible to enter the IOD number? And the response was, well, it has a keypad, so it is possible. But then he explained why he didn't think it was likely or why it would work that way. But even their expert acknowledged it would have been possible, given the keypad that exists in Coffee, to type it in and to be able to type it in that way. And that's perfectly consistent with the disclosure in Coffee at column 55, lines 6 to 7, that it does, in fact, have a keypad and that it can use the skilled artisan, as it says at line 7 to 9 of that column, can use that to type in a response or other data. So when you have silence about how the IOD makes it over, there's this keypad, and everyone acknowledges you can use the keypad to type in information. This is not an inherency case. It's not necessarily present. And that's why I didn't hear a lot of it today, but in their brief, they kind of keep talking about these other standards that could apply, like reasonably infer or what you would at once envisage, even though NIDEC says you can't use that to fill in a missing limitation. So I'm happy to answer any other questions the court has, but otherwise we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I just want to begin by giving you all the pin site. I want to point the court to Appendix 590 to 591. This is during our rebuttal time below. Mr. Wolf, starting at the bottom of Appendix 590, says he would ask a question, judge, about copied information and where that was found in the petition. And then he points specifically to page 38 and 39 of the petition, which corresponds to Appendix 116 and 117, the passages we were just discussing. So in the rebuttal time, the board was specifically pointing to those passages.
And so, and what were you? What were the pages in the appendix you were citing from?
590 to 591. I want to address the point made by my friend on the other side that the petition was confusing and hard to unpack. You know, I think the board started out from this false premise, and is repeated by my friend on the other side, that it has to be expressed in this reference. And this court has consistently rejected an ipsimis verbis test. In other words, it doesn't have to be spelled out in exactly the words in the prior art. There's a Shaumin case which rejects that ipsimis verbis, and it says it exalts form over substance. And again, what we have to do is look through the mind of a skilled artist and understand what the teachings of the reference are. And that does involve, you know, looking beyond what it explicitly says. And going on to obviousness, you know, I do think that issue was fairly before the board. You know, I think that we did enough to raise it, and certainly an expert body such as the board is familiar with this court's precedents, has done obviousness a bajillion and a half times. I think what we did was sufficient to preserve that. If the court does not have any other questions, we will rest on the briefs.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.